This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
China hardened its language towards Taiwan on Thursday, saying independence means war. The warning came after recent stepped-up military activities on the island nation. China has long claimed Taiwan as its own territory. Taiwan began military exercises on Tuesday after several Chinese warplanes entered its air defense space over the weekend. The action led the United States to urge China to stop pressuring Taiwan and reaffirm its support for the independent territory. At a monthly news briefing Thursday, Chinese Defense Ministry spokesman Wu Qian defended its military activities in the Taiwan Strait. He called it a necessary answer to external forces and Taiwan's independence forces. Wu said a handful of people in Taiwan were seeking the island's independence. We warn those Taiwan independence forces, those who play with fire will burn themselves, and Taiwan independence means war, he added. While China has never promised to avoid the use of force to bring Taiwan under its control, it is unusual for a government official to make such a threat. Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council replied that China should think carefully and not underestimate the island's determination to defend itself. Taiwan's Defense Ministry reported that China sent 13 military aircraft, including 4 J-10 fighter jets and 8 H-6K bombers, into its airspace over the weekend. They were near the Taiwan-controlled Pratas Islands at the top end of the South China Sea, and Taiwanese Air Force jets took to the skies in a show of battle readiness. The Chinese action came as a U.S. carrier battle group led by the USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea Saturday. The U.S. military said its purpose there is to demonstrate support for freedom of the seas. The move came just days after new U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Under the administration of former President Donald Trump, the U.S. increased arms sales to the territory and permitted senior American officials to visit the island. Linda Thomas Greenfield is President Biden's nominee to become the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. During her Senate confirmation hearing Wednesday, she called China a strategic adversary and added the U.S. needs to support Taiwan as a democracy. China believes that the Taiwan government of President Tsai Ing-wen is moving the island towards a declaration of formal independence. but Tsai has repeatedly said it is already an independent country called the Republic of China, its official name. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Past right-wing extremism incidents mostly took place in rural parts of the United States. They include when right-wing extremists occupied a federal bird sanctuary in Oregon in 2016. In 1992, there was a conflict between white separatists and federal agents in Ruby Ridge, Idaho. And in 1995, extremist Timothy McVeigh bombed a federal building in Oklahoma City and killed 168 people. But the attack by rioters on the U.S. Capitol targeted the heart of American government. It also brought together large numbers of people who belong to extremist groups, giving them the chance to establish links to each other. One expert said the incident might let them work together toward other violent actions. "The events have a radicalizing effect," said Brian Michael Jenkins. "The Battle of Capitol Hill is now part of mythology." Jenkins is a terrorism expert and advisor to the president of the RAND Corporation Research Center in California. Mary McCord is a former acting U.S. Assistant Attorney General for National Security. She said the environment for the attack had been building throughout the term of former President Donald Trump. She listed the 2017 Unite the Right white supremacist demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which one person was killed. She also listed demonstrations at state capitals by armed protesters angry about COVID-19 public health safety orders and mass shootings by people expressing racial or anti-government hatred. "All have led to this moment," said McCord in an email to the Associated Press. She is now a visiting law professor at Georgetown University Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center watches U.S. extremist groups. It has recorded a 55% increase in the number of what it calls white nationalist hate groups since 2017. Among those who attacked the Capitol on January 6th were members of the Oath Keepers. They are an extremist group that seeks members among the military and police. The Proud Boys were there too. There were followers of QAnon, which spreads conspiracy theories, and people who are angry about race, religion, and other issues. January 6 was kind of a Woodstock of the angry right, Jenkins said. Woodstock was a 1968 rock music performance that brought thousands of young people together. "The mere fact those groups were coming together sharing this anger, it is going to have effects," he said. I'm Susan Shand.
Imagine that verbs, nouns, and other parts of language are competing with each other. One verb form or noun might beat a competing verb form or noun. Much like in the World Cup, the winners go to the next round, and the losers no longer play. Keep that comparison in mind as we explore today's subject, the present perfect. Imagine you hear English speakers say the following words.
Do you want to get some dinner?
No, thanks. I've already eaten dinner.
The second speaker said, I've already eaten, short for I have already eaten. This is the present perfect. It suggests that the action of eating has been completed. In other words, the speaker ate at some point in the past, but the speaker is not eating now. Note that the word already suggests that the event took place before the present point in time. Betty Azar's Understanding and Using English Grammar describes the present perfect in terms of form and meaning. The form is have plus past participle. The meaning, notes Azar, is that the perfect tenses all give the idea that one thing happens before another time or event. Other grammar experts have explored the present perfect in a slightly different way. In Understanding English Grammar, Martha Kohn and Robert Funk note that the present perfect can suggest a connection with the present. Here is an example of what they mean.
Joe has lived in Washington, D.C. since 1973.
In this example, the present perfect suggests that Joe began living in Washington, D.C. in the past and continues to live there in the present. The word since, followed by the year 1973, gives you a clue about the meaning. These examples show you general ways in which the present perfect is used today. But the present perfect had different uses in the past. And it is also playing a part in a kind of language competition, as we will see. Xinyue Yao is a language expert. In 2014, she explored the English present perfect in the Journal of English Linguistics. Yao wrote that the modern present perfect came from the transitive have plus past participle structure in Old English. In Old English, the structure often suggested a kind of possession. Yao notes, a statement such as, I have finished my work in Old English would be different in Modern English. It would mean something closer to, I possess or have my work in a finished condition. But the possessive meaning was lost over time, Yao adds. In the past, English speakers used a competing be plus past participle structure to suggest completed actions, but that structure declined in use over time. In other words, the have plus past participle structure won out. A 2018 paper in Ortisol noted the difficulties in teaching the present perfect to English learners, especially learners of American English. One reason is that the present perfect is used much less often in American English. Mina Gavel, the writer of the paper, noted the present perfect is being replaced by its main competitor, the simple past, in American English. She adds that the perfects, and especially the present perfect, make up only 5 to 10% of spoken American English verb use and are even less prevalent in speaking than writing. Prevalent is a term that means common or widespread. Think back to the words you heard at the beginning of this report.
Do you want to get some dinner?
No, thanks. I've already eaten dinner.
The second speaker used the present perfect. But a speaker of American English might also use the simple past, as in,
Do you want to get some dinner?
No, thanks. I already ate.
Today, we explored how the present perfect has competed, and does compete, for use. In American English, the present perfect has been losing out to the simple past for some time, but the present perfect is still in the game. In other kinds of English, such as British English, the present perfect is more commonly used. And in Australian English, the present perfect can have a very interesting, unusual meaning. But that is a subject for a future report. The next time you are reading a book, watching a film, or listening to the news, pay careful attention to the present perfect. Keep notes about the times you hear or read it. Over time, you will begin to use it with great ease. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions during the 1920s. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France because many American citizens had families in those countries. But fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws, and millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long unprotected border with Canada, or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor, and shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books, The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man, in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Brian remained popular among many traditional Americans. Brian told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. He accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Brian and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech. And they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Brian and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Brian himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Brian question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Brian know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Brian answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. It was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II, but neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, of change, and of struggle between the old and new values.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.